We are in the 33rd lesson in the book of Judges today. And we are in Judges chapter 18. And where we left off last week was in verse number 14. And that's where we're going to pick up again today. What had happened up until this point, as you will remember, five men of the Danites had gone up and found a place up north of Lake Merion, way at the very top north part of the Promised Land, the very apex of it at the top. And they wanted some land besides the land that had been given to them by Joshua. And so they went and found that land. They came back to their home area by Zorah and Eshtaol, and they gathered 600 warriors. And as they're headed back up to go take the land up there north and to take that town of Laish for themselves and make it a new area for them to live, they stopped at Micah's house on the way. Remember Micah with the Levite priest and the idols. And while they're camped at Micah's house, the five Danite spies tell the 600 men about the gold idols that are inside the house. And that's in verse number 14. We began reading it last week, and that's where we actually ended our lesson last week, was in the middle of the passage, but I want to pick back up and read it again. Verse number 14. Then the five men who went to spy out the country of Laish said to their kinsmen, "Do you know that there are in these houses an ephod and household idols and a graven image and a molten image? Now therefore, consider what you should do." They turned aside there and came to the house of the young man, the Levite, in the house of Micah, and asked him of his welfare. The 600 men armed with their weapons of war, who were of the sons of Dan, stood by the entrance of the gate. Now the five men who went to spy out the land went up and entered there and took the graven image and the ephod and the household idols and molten image, while the priest stood by the entrance of the gate with the 600 men armed with weapons of war. Evil always drags along evil. These silver idols were worth more than most men could ever even imagine. And it was such a temptation. These men stole the idols and the beautiful priest robe while that false Levite priest just stood there and watched. And to his credit, the false Levite priest of the false god questioned the Danites who took the idols. To his credit, but not to his best. Verse number 18. When these went into Micah's house and took the graven image, the ephod, and the household idols, the molten image, the priest said to them, "What are you doing?" The Danites answered the false Levite priest in verse number 19. They said to him, "Be silent, put your hand over your mouth and come with us, and be to us as a father and a priest. Is it better for you to be a priest to the household of one man or to be a priest to the tribe and a family of Israel?" The priest's heart was glad, and he took the ephod and the household idols and the graven images and went among the people. The Levite priest was offered a new job as the priest of a whole tribe, rather than just being the priest of one person. The priest took the job. He left Micah's house. He's got the ephod, he's got the molten idols, he's got the graven image, and he helped with the theft of Micah's property. Evil drags along evil. Once that theft was noticed, we see that Micah wants his idols back. Verse number 21. Then they turned and departed and put the little ones and the livestock and the valuables in front of them And when they had gone some distance from the house of Micah, the men who were in the house near Micah's house assembled and overtook the sons of Dan. They cried to the sons of Dan, who turned around and said to Micah, "What is the matter with you that you have assembled together?" And he said, "You have taken away my gods, which I made, and the priest, and have gone away, and what do I have besides? So how can you say to me, 'What is the matter with you?'" Micah was able to assemble, get this, an army to catch up with the Danite army. There, Micah made his case, and he stated his loss. But the Danite army replied back to Micah. And we see that the Danites win, and Micah loses. Verse number 25. The sons of Dan said to him, "Do not let your voice be heard among us, or else fierce men will fall upon you and you will lose your life with the lives of your household." So the sons of Dan went on their way, and when Micah saw that they were too strong for him, he turned and went back to his house. It must have been evident to Micah that he did not have the militia strong enough to beat the army of the Danites. His possessions were stolen, and he could not do anything about it. Well, at the end of the 120-mile march, we come to Dan's great sin in the hill country of Laish. We start with the capture of the city of Laish in verse number 27. "Then they took what Micah had made and the priests who had belonged to him and came to Laish, to a people quiet and secure, and struck them with the edge of the sword, and they burned the city with fire. And there was no one to deliver them because it was far from Sidon, and they had no dealings with anyone. And it was in the valley which is near Beth Rehob. And they rebuilt the city and lived in it." Here's the problem with a city that feels safe and secure. The people are never prepared. The Danites caught them off guard. The city was so far off the grid that it was impossible to garner the help that was needed from anyone to defeat the Danites. Neither did it have positive relationships with any of the villages nearby to garner help. And once the city was destroyed, the Danites promptly rebuilt it for their own use. Rebuilding the city, the Danites changed the name of the city in verse number 29. "They called the name of the city Dan, after the name of Dan their father, who was born in Israel. However, the name of the city formerly was Laish." And as the Danites were building the city with its new name, they commissioned priests of the city. Now catch this, verse number 30. "The sons of Dan set up for themselves the graven image. And Jonathan, the son of Gershom, the son of Manasseh, he and his sons were priests to the tribe of the Danites until the day of the captivity of the land. So they set up for themselves Micah's graven image which he had made all the time that the house of God was at Shiloh." We know that something went wrong because Gershom's son, Jonathan, acted as priest to the Danites when they set up the graven image for the tribe. And what do we know? Let me tell you, the Hebrew custodians of the sacred scripture, who jealously guarded the integrity of the text and used ingenious devices to preserve their pristine purity of the text, seem to have deliberately changed the name of Jonathan's grandfather from Moses to Manasseh here in Judges chapter 18, verse 30, to disguise the fact that Moses had such an outrageous descendant. No doubt the scribes thought that Moses would have turned over in his grave if he knew what his grandson had done. Be that as it may, the tribe of Dan took land that was not theirs, destroyed lives that they were not authorized to destroy, established a place of worship of a false god that they were not authorized to establish. They then enlisted something good. They enlisted proper Levites to be the priest, even though they were descendants of Moses and not Manasseh. Why they changed Moses' name to Manasseh, we'll never know. Now we come to a difficult portion of the scripture where it says this: He and his sons were priests to the tribe of the Danites until the day of the captivity of the land. So they set up for themselves Micah's graven image, which he had made all the time that the house of God was at Shiloh. When was the captivity of the land? Well, it could not have been the capture of the land by the Assyrians. Samuel, the writer of this Pat book, could not have possibly known about the capture of the Assyrian Empire, to capture this land when Tiglath-Pileser was the king. Could not have known. It was hundreds of years in the future. This must mean the capture of the land at Shiloh, which is mentioned in this passage when the Philistines won the battle against King Saul and captured the ark. Samuel saw that happen. And when the ark left Shiloh, where the tabernacle complex had set for hundreds of years, it would never be returned to Shiloh again. The Philistines captured the land, and with it they captured the ark. However, the ark brought great harm to them, and they cried uncle, and they sent the ark back, as you remember the story, to the nation of Israel. Samuel saw all this. Things changed in the nation when the ark was captured, as we will see in our future study of 1 Samuel. But for now, we know the name of the young Levite. We finally know his name that stayed at Micah's house and moved with the Danites north. His name was Jonathan. He was the grandson down the line from Moses, from Gershom, Moses' son. The writer will retrace this same timeline to tell us about another Levite from Bethlehem in the next sad, sad story. But before we leave this current story, we must make one observation. Had the writer not told us about Dan capturing a new area to make as their home in that far north part of the Promised Land, the story that we are going to read when we get to chapter 20 would not make sense if this story was not there. Neither would the mention of the city of Dan when it is used throughout the rest of the whole Old Testament stories make any sense whatsoever, because the city of Dan was in that new stolen part of the tribe of Dan, not in its original location. We will show you why in the first instance when we reach chapter 20 and verse number 1. But we're not there yet. We are still in chapter 19, verse number 1. From the nation's defiance of the law to the worshiping of a graven image, the writer introduces us to a nation's indifference to the law. From the defiance of the law to the indifference of the law, to this, the disobedience of the law. Shiloh was a city where the tabernacle complex was permanently stationed from just after the crossing of the Jordan River until the Ark of the Covenant was taken in battle by the Philistines. They took it away from King Saul. It was captured by the Philistines. And in the story, Eli is the high priest. And Samuel is a silent judge of Israel, just as he is here in the book of Judges. Now, we say silent here because Samuel is writing this record in this book of Judges, and he does not mention himself. However, during his life, he was not silent in any way. The people knew all about Samuel. They will soon reach out to him to select a king, and he will be the one to name the king. The king will be King Saul. That one fact shows that Samuel was basically the defunct, highest-ranking judge in the magistrate judicial system that Moses put in place. He is stationed in his home tribal area of Ephraim. And we like to think that Samuel stayed at the tabernacle complex all his life with Eli, but he didn't. Remember, his mother delivered him to Eli when he was about 4 years old, and he grew up assisting in the tabernacle complex. However, when he was older, he was seen going here and there as a judge and a prophet. And for that reason, Samuel knew about the sin of the nation's defiance of the law with Micah's idols and his personal priest and in his godless home. Samuel also learned about the nation's disobedience of the law in this new story about this Levite man who lived in Ephraim's territory. We begin hearing about this Levite's sin in the hill country of Ephraim and his marriage to the concubine here in chapter 19. This is not the same Levite as before, because that Levite before is up in the area of Dan. This is a new Levite who is in the hill country of Ephraim, and he is married to a concubine. Chapter 19, verse number 1. Now it came about in those days, when there was no king in Israel, that there was a certain Levite staying in the remote part of the hill country of Ephraim, who took a concubine for himself from Bethlehem in Judea. Since the end of Samson's story, the writer has told us four times that there was no king in Israel. This is the fifth time. He will say it one more time before this book is over, and it will be the last line in the book. Why? By the time Samuel writes this book, all its information will have long been past completed. The nation will have King Saul ruling over them at their request, and at the announcement of his name by Samuel as selected by the Lord, Samuel is now setting the stage for why the nation concludes that the judicial system set up by the Lord and declared by Moses was not enough to meet the needs of the people. They will ask Samuel for a king because he was viewed as the chief of the judges because of his God-given authority. It has not been written yet. This book has not. But in a year or two, it will. When they ask Samuel for a king, and the Lord will say to Samuel this. In 1 Samuel chapter 8, verse 7, the Lord will say to Samuel, "Listen to the voice of the people in regard to all that they say to you, for they have not rejected you, but they have rejected me from being king over them." This too implies that the Lord intended to be the king over Israel forever. He had given them all they needed to know to stay within His divine will, and He would protect them and guide them if they followed His commands, His laws, His statutes, and His ordinances. And that is why the Lord had the ordinances concerning the reading of the law every seventh year in the sabbatical year after taking the promised land, but the people would not adhere to the law even though they had heard it every 7 years, word for word. Thus Samuel is setting the stage for the request of a king by telling us in total there was no king in Israel. The last straw comes with this story of the Levite who took a concubine for a wife. The concubine was from the tribe of Judah. Specifically, her home was also in Bethlehem. A concubine was a wife. However, she was not considered a primary wife. She was not the first wife of a wedding. There was nothing wrong with a Levite taking a wife from the tribe of Judah, as is this case. Any man of Israel could legally, under the law, take a wife from any of the other tribes of Israel. Any offspring of that wife, but with that wife, would be considered a child of the father's tribal bloodline. The question really comes down in this passage as to why the Levite took a concubine as a wife. A concubine, by the notion of her position, was never the primary wife. If a woman was the first to marry the man, she would never be called a concubine. In other words, this Levite already had a wife. The primary reason to take a concubine was to have children. Such was the case with Hagar and Abraham when Sarah was barren during most of her married life, well past the age where she should be able to have a child. It was the case with Leah and Rachel with Jacob when both girls were barren in their first years of marriage and they gave their maidservants to be concubines with Jacob after birthing children. At this point, we can also remember that four of Jacob's sons were from concubines who are now tribal tribes in the nation of Israel. But get their names. Dan, who we're talking about. Naphtali, Gad, and Asher. Sons of concubines. Yet even though their mothers were concubines, their status as a son of Israel was as if they were the son of the primary wife. And as we have seen with Abimelech and Jephthah in this book, the status of the concubine sons was not always adhered to as if they were Jacob's sons or Gideon's sons. Later in the Bible, we will learn that some women availed themselves to be concubines for reasons such as royal prestige, or as simple as attaching to a man who had the means to provide for daily life and sustenance. The Levite had taken this concubine from Bethlehem and settled back in his home in the hill country of Ephraim. The writer now tells us of the unfaithfulness of the concubine to the Levite in verse number 2. But this concubine played the harlot against him, and she went away from him to her father's house in Bethlehem in Judah, and was there for a period of 4 months. This verse, as simple as it seems, is tough to understand. First, only a wedded wife could commit adultery as a harlot. So I say that because we are talking about this woman. For clarity, only a married man could commit adultery too against his wife. A single woman or man cannot commit adultery. A sexual indiscretion between singles is called by a different word, fornication. An unmarried harlot prostitute commits fornication, even though her sinful partner may be a married man committing adultery against his wife. Follow that. Second, the text says that she played the harlot. It does not say she became a harlot. In the book of Judges, each time the writer uses the phrase played a harlot, it refers to Israel being unfaithful to the Lord by leaving Him and seeking other gods. Judges chapter 2:17, 8:27, 8:33. Perhaps this concubine was simply unfaithful to this Levite because she went home to return to her parents' house. Perhaps there was an argument within the family. We do not know. But if there was the phrase, she played the harlot, that would fit the intent of this passage just as well as if she had become unfaithful to stay with her husband in the marriage relationship whether or not she had had a relationship with any other man. It did not matter. It does not say she was a harlot in Bethlehem either, where she was for 4 months. She was unfaithful to her husband. She played the harlot by being unfaithful, like being unfaithful to the Lord, and she left her husband and went back to her home. Well, at the end of 4 months, we come to the retrieving of the concubine by the Levite husband and the invitation to spend the night in her father's house. Chapter 19, verse number 3. Then her husband arose and went after her to speak tenderly to her in order to bring her back, taking with him his servant and a pair of donkeys. So she brought him into her father's house, and when the girl's father saw him, he was glad to meet him. His father-in-law, the girl's father, detained him, and he remained with him 3 days. So they ate and drank and lodged there. And now on the fourth day, they got up early in the morning, and he prepared to go. And the girl's father said to his son-in-law, "Sustain yourself with a piece of bread, and afterwards you may go." So both of them sat down and ate and drank together. And the girl's father said to him, "Please be willing to spend the night and let your heart be merry." Then the man arose to go, but his father-in-law urged him so that he spent the night there again. And on the fifth day, he arose to go early in the morning. And the girl's father said, "Please sustain yourself and wait until afternoon." So both of them ate. And when the man arose to go along with his concubine and servant, his father-in-law, the girl's father said to him, "Behold now, the day is drawn to a close. Please spend the night. Lo, the day is coming to an end. Spend the night here, that your heart may be merry. Then tomorrow you may arise early for the journey, so that you may go home."